Hi, I'm Susie Davies, and I am going to talk about a study that we did, a qualitative study, challenges facing African-American communities in the Deep South. I'd like to thank my colleagues, Yukyung Lee, who is here, Harpreet Thin, Susan Andre, and Lonnie Hannon, who grew up in Woodlawn, where I'm going to talk about where the study took place, and he was our data collector and research interviewer. So I advance the slides, okay, sorry. So Woodlawn is not unlike a lot of other very low-income, resource-poor communities in the Deep South. As you know, the social determinants are more and more contributing to a variety of conditions, but particularly HIV and STIs, and African-American males are particularly at risk for HIV and gonorrhea, syphilis, and early fatherhood. They are much more likely to experience racism, discrimination, and other psychosocial stressors that compromise their mental health and quality of life. They are very hard to reach, especially the emerging adult population that we worked with, 19 to 24, that have finished their schooling. Whether or not they graduated, they are not attending former schooling, they are on or underemployed, and they are likely to be living at home or not reached the traditional landmarks that we think of in adulthood. Emerging adulthood is kind of a new developmental stage that is characterized by, across the sociodemographic spectrum, especially males, it seems, living at home at the age of 25, continuing to kind of, you know, find their way and less likely to reach those adult landmarks from previous generations. But so recognizing that they're hard to reach and it's imperative that we understand their experiences the way they perceive them, it was important to involve them actively and also try to talk to a number of other audiences to figure out how best to help them. The pictures here, the one on the top is Woodlawn High School. Woodlawn used to be a very prestigious, high SES community in Birmingham. Unfortunately, white flight in the 60s, a lot of people moved out. The movie, I don't know if any of you have heard about Woodlawn, it's a true story. About a high school team, and it just opened a couple of weeks ago, and it was filmed actually at Woodlawn High School. I encourage you to see it. Why am I back at the beginning? I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. So we involved three populations, used multiple data sources to try to understand the experience of these males and the larger structural influences. We know that our environments can affect mental and physical health in a number of ways. Institutional resources, Dr. Francois talked about risk and protective factors and how important they both are, and for every risk you want a buffer of a protective factor. Obviously, we didn't see many of those in Woodlawn. Relationships with others, our environment affects our both the quality and quantity and density of our relationships with others. African-American males who disengage for other reasons are less likely to have those protective relationships that could serve to benefit them in many ways. And norms collective efficacy is a very powerful influence on all. I keep doing that, I'm sorry. Okay, so our primary audience are African-American emerging adult males, 19 to 24 years old. They had to have lived in the Woodlawn area for 5 or more years and be currently sexually active and plan to stay in the neighborhood for another 6 months. They were recruited via street intercept techniques. Lonnie Hannon, who grew up in Woodlawn, very likable person, now on the faculty at Tuskegee, was the one that interviewed them. He did individual interviews that shaped the focus group questions that we asked. We then had two separate focus groups, and all of them completed written surveys. We then talked to community leaders. These were individuals in the community that included a police officer, school administrator, healthcare providers, teachers, coach, clergy, neighborhood elders, variety of individuals that knew the audience well, that came to Woodlawn daily to work and interacted with the intended population. We then had a third audience. There was a neighborhood group that they called themselves the Eastern Area Health Advisory Council, a group of neighbors, friends, family, concerned citizens that were worried about Woodlawn and its health and quality of life, and were motivated to try to increase the quality of life and the resources in Woodlawn. So we held a focus group with them. As everyone knows, and as the speakers before me so eloquently demonstrated, the built environment has tremendous direct and indirect effects on our physical and our mental health. Poor quality housing, residential crowding, which is the number of people living in a room, something that you see a lot of in Woodlawn. Loud exterior noise. Woodlawn happens to be the closest neighborhood from the local airport, can all cause psychological distress. Indirectly, the built environment can affect mental health by reducing one's perceived level of perceived control, increasing their perceived helplessness, and it's been shown both in laboratory and natural studies to reduce task persistence, both in children and adults. Social support can be reduced with household crowding and restoration, another important indirect effect. When you have multiple stressors that are coming from lots of different directions and you don't have that opportunity to return to baseline or get your equilibrium back, you have residual stress and cognitive fatigue. And these are individuals that don't only suffer from one or two, but they suffer from multiple stressors, both in their physical and social environments daily. So we also did an ethnography, an abbreviated ethnography. And the conclusion of that was that Woodlawn is a very resource-poor area, but it's surrounded by a city with resources. Buses do run hourly to available resources. What few resources that were available specifically for African American young adult males were rarely utilized. When you look at the physical landscape of Woodlawn, you'll see a number of vacant buildings. The one bank that was in town moved out of town, and it was quite a walk for residents. And you can see that's a picture of the currency exchange establishments that pop up as neighborhoods start spiraling down, and they are a perfect representation of businesses that come in and exploit impoverished populations. Of course, being in the Deep South, there's a church on almost every corner. And as I mentioned, it is right next to the airport. So it's important when I share these perceptions of the problem that, as you all know, with qualitative data, there's lots of different ways to interpret how people say things, and especially if you're a white middle-aged female and you're not a young African-American male living in a very low-income community. So it's important, and I've worked hard to look at a number of ways to perceive the problem, and it's really hard to try to get all these data into a 15-minute talk, so bear with me as I'm trying to kind of quickly go through. So one of the things that, you know, very easy for them to say, gosh, you know, GED classes are really hard to get to, you have to pay to take the test, no available jobs, the ones that are available, you have to start at the bottom, the system's against us, we have no control over it, why even try, the system is rigged against us, teachers are biased, clergy are hypocritical. And we called the GED place and we said, is it true that it's really hard to get to? No, it's right on the bus line, they let you right out. It's free, the classes are free, we have young males come, they sign up, they don't come back. And you'll hopefully understand a little bit why it's important to not take the simple explanation of these. Diversity of perceptions. We were bought here, they mean brought, well, maybe bought here, slaves. We still look at as slaves, and if we do make it, we'll just be slavery. And with money, we children of ex-slaves, you know what I'm saying, it ain't nothing but prisoners, so we ain't really got no choice, and what's called the American dream. I was with the job program and they couldn't find me job because of my criminal record, and then with no education and no training skills, it's hard, and then when we do try to make some money, they want to lock us out. Politicians want your vote, but they don't want to do nothing for you. More quotes from the primary audience, and this is a different perspective. As a matter of fact, in one of the focus groups, we almost had a physical fight. There were some that were, as I'm going to read, very much, you know, feeling like if we work hard and work together, there are things that we can do, and there were others that were you know, less comfortable with some of the opinions that were shared. I think people, it got to start with us. It got to start with people that's really concerned. Back in the old days, they rang a bell and they had community meeting. We as a black population in this community, we need to ring a bell and come to our meeting and sit down and not discuss the problem, but the solution. If you don't set no type of standards or no goals or nothing like this for our kids, they gonna do the same thing that us and everybody else around our age doing, and that's hanging in the street, messing with the prostitutes, selling the dope, going to jail. Talk to your kids. If we start out with our kids, we can wipe AIDS out. The parents should have patience for their kids, show them that you love them, and show them that you're there for them. So then the two other populations, the neighbors, friends, and family focus group and the community leaders, male youth don't access available programs, they don't identify with them or they're not interested, many don't stay in the programs, they sign up but then they don't come, hard to involve them when apathy is there, they reject the system, take the easy way out, the role models they choose are the wrong ones. African-American males did perceive a number of solutions. Again, maybe their expectations are not realistic. They want opportunities to be more appealing. They want programs easier to use, give available jobs to us before the Mexicans, make the system fair, give us a chance. Blacks who succeed should pull others up with them. The other two neighbor, oh, really? Okay, thank you. Community, okay, I'm just gonna, you see that. Okay, so concern over HIV, remember that was what we were going in and expecting to find, and most of what they talked about wasn't HIV. They didn't bring it up at all until we asked them, do you think HIV is a problem in your community? Oh gosh, yes, it is. And then they talked about it. But there are so many other pressing daily struggles that they experience every day. Thanks. Okay, so there are aware that HIV is a burden. Conspiracy theories detract from personal behavior. They injected these 40 black men with syphilis and let them go out and spread it. You know, that's not really the way it happened, but the Tuskegee syphilis study was absolutely terrible, but they didn't inject anybody with syphilis. But we know more crackers use drugs through needles. Crackers have more unprotected sex than black people. So how is it rising? I don't trust it. They saw it as biological warfare. The World Health Organization started it. Another said that the CDC, it's called the Center for Disease Control, they control how much of it gets out there and how many people get it. Like all conspiracy theories, you know, if you look for examples, you can find examples, and you can see how they can look around and see a completely decimated community, and no one's doing anything about it, and a community over, there's all these resources. It's easy to conclude that, you know, nobody cares about them. Doggone it. Okay, I keep pushing back, sorry, okay. So there were areas that they agreed most, okay, I just want to read this because families were very important. The males reported family and community violence, seeing it firsthand. Obviously single and teen parenthood, unsupervised children, maternal depression, and increased family conflict as common adversities. A lot of parents don't have time to be with their kids and work two jobs. Kids are basically raising themselves, or the older children are raising them. A whole lot of this would have turned out better. It's really sad. And there was another man that said, I just wish I could start over if I had even one or two of the opportunities that most people in the US had. So understanding the disconnection is really important. And you know, these are men that have been discriminated at school, in the workplace, and there's something called perceived anticipatory discrimination. When you're young and you're growing up and you see parents and peers and other people discriminated against, it's easy to anticipate that it's going to happen to you. So maybe rather than just saying we want things to be easier, it's that they are afraid of trying and being rejected. They've already experienced failure, rejection. And so here is my last slide, that it's important to increase community and public health capacity to provide prevention programs to this very high-risk population. But more and better programs are not the answer until we address the underlying issues that are causing them to not take advantage of the existing programs. And until they feel understood, it's going to be very unlikely that they're going to, you know, do something different and not continue to look at what the traditional majority covets and reject that. And just to show you that Birmingham has made some progress, unfortunately, everyone remembers the police dogs, and while the police is holding the boy, letting the dog, we now have a wonderful civil rights institute that doesn't try to gloss over anything and really is trying to be a place of healing. I don't know why I keep pushing that one, it's just making it go backwards. Thank you. Thank you.
I want to invite everyone to take a brief minute and stand up and stretch and think about whether you have questions for the panelists. If you would take a step, everyone stand up. Move your feet a little bit, move your arms a little bit. Reflect on the the four very, very different and yet complementary messages that we heard here, as well as some very provocative messages. I have some questions, but I wanted to open it up to the floor for anybody who had burning questions they wanted to get answers from our panelists. Questions from the audience? All right, so my question is for each one of you, and I'm sorry we don't have table mics, so you'll have to jump up and come up here. Reflecting on the work that you did, some really interesting learnings in each case, if you had time to go back and do it over again, what would you do differently?